has been working in coalition to deliver hot meals to camps of people experiencing homelessness and doing wellness checks in low-income neighborhoods of color in South Dallas. Higgins said the group's work has been most important in regard to people with mobility issues or others who are worried about leaving their homes or encampments. The city did a pretty good job on setting up stations and places for people to go to get warm, but the problem is actually getting people there, Higgins told reporters. Then they were using electronic ways of letting people know that these resources are out there. And if your power is out, then how are you charging your phone to be able to see all these resources? The climate-fueled storm, Higgins says, amplified long-standing issues of environmental racism, lack of development, and old and neglected infrastructure in the under-resourced neighborhoods of South Dallas. These communities have long suffered a cycle of environmental degradation after major highways broke up neighborhoods and invited heavy industry into the area, which in turn has long taken an environmental and health toll on the community, creating a downward spiral. When the storm hit, these issues compounded, and the city hasn't done enough to mitigate the harm, Higgins says. That's why he and other mutual aid organizers are doing all they can to help support the largely black community. The inaction on the city level from the mayor, just not having a citywide coordinated response for this type of work, I think, is a big value statement about the way our city operates, Higgins says. But you layer all those things on top of each other and you got a serious crisis. You've got systematic problems coming to bear in real time and breaking down and eroding everything even more with folks not having power and not having water. Meanwhile, on the border, organizers with a La Union del Pueblo intro, LUPE, distributed gift cards, blankets, and food to poor Latinos living in border colonies during the freeze last week and are continuing to provide aid as conditions improve. LUPE Communications Coordinator John Michael Torres told reporters that some colonies' neighborhoods also lost water after power went offline, since the wells they rely on use an electric-operated pumps. Many fled to family members' homes or hotels, which were quickly booked. Other border neighborhoods that have basic plumbing also experienced burst pipes, like so many others in the state. In the colonies, as in South Dallas, Torres says the freeze exacerbated already existing problems of environmental justice. Many of the colonies' neighborhoods that lost power and water are the same neighborhoods that have been hit the hardest by flooding, as predatory housing developers built some neighborhoods on semi-rural land in the region's floodplains. Many of these neighborhoods are located in South Texas City's extraterritorial jurisdictions and are still waiting for cities and counties to extend proper wastewater removal infrastructure to their areas. These are the same neighborhoods that have suffered for years from the effects of poor drainage, property damage, and sickness that comes with flooding, Torres says. These areas where people are marginalized in a very difficult way from jobs and services are also marginalized from the spaces where they can lead active and healthy lives. The impact on the geographic marginalization of these communities plays out in sicker, less healthy communities that struggle more, and then when there is a bigger, badder storm that hits, they are even more vulnerable. Mutual aid organizers and directly impacted Texans want to see real consequences for state leadership's negligence and violence. In particular, people are calling attention to Senator Ted Cruz, who fled the state to vacation in Cancun, Mexico, and Governor Abbott, who appoints the three-member Public Utilities Commission, PUC, overseeing the nonprofit Electric Reliability Council of Texas, ERCOT, which operates the state's independent grid and initiated the statewide blackout that affected up to 4 million Texans recently. Abbott has shifted blame to ERCOT, calling for investigations and reforms to the grid operator as an emergency item for the 2021 legislative session, allowing the state legislature to approve bills on a topic during the first 60 days. But Abbott's blame game in regard to ERCOT, much like his misleading statements about the state's wind turbines, avoids his own culpability. Experts point out that ERCOT doesn't even possess the enforcement power to require energy generators to upgrade and winterize their facilities. The legislature would need to implement those requirements, and it's up to the PUC and the Texas Railroad Commission, which regulates oil and gas, to enforce regulations that apply to power companies. King Hollis, whose pipes burst and flooded his home in McKinney, Texas recently, wants to see ERCOT abolished and Texas become integrated into the U.S. two larger national power grids. Hollis is a black filmmaker who has worked on issues of police-perpetrated violence and with the Dallas-based Earth X Film to showcase environmentally themed film on Earth Day. After his pipes burst, recently, he and his family and friends worked to bail water from his home using large containers for a number of hours before they were forced to evacuate. He is now staying with a friend while dealing with the aftermath of the flood. I think Abbott's whole move regarding ERCOT is spin and a political shield to continue business as usual. He is going to slap people on the hand, keep the deregulations and cuddle corporations, Hollis told reporters. What the hell are you trying to reform? You are reforming something that does not work, because we have seen here cannot be fixed with a couple of notes from the governor. His experience, Holy says, is evidence of environmental racism and the ways in which the state's leadership has created environmental sacrifice zones and communities like his for the sake of deregulation and a corporate bottom line. Holy railed against Senator Cruz abandoning his post as a public servant to vacation in Cancun. It is time to replace these politicians. It is time for people to run for office and get these babysitters for corporations out of office, he says. I've got a hot hand for a hot ballot. My hands are ready for that ballot box. Still, Holy says he was overwhelmed by the amount of support he received from friends and neighbors of all the strips who reached out with offers of food, water, and a place to stay. We have to stop letting politicians and pundits on cable news tell us who we are, Holy says. We know what to do when this hits the fan. We define ourselves in times like these. South Dallas Mutual Aid organizer Higgins agrees ERCOT should be abolished. It would be good for us to integrate into national grid because then there would be some kind of federal regulation, but there is just a lot of players here and a lot of elite folks who have made a lot of money that want to see things stay the way they are. In addition to wanting Texas to abolish ERCOT and rejoin the national grids, organizers are calling for deeper investments in vulnerable communities of color and in the renewable sector. They want a Green New Deal. We do need an investment in green energy, green jobs in our colonies, in our region, and throughout the state of Texas. LUPE's Torres says, there is no reason that our community members, our sons and our daughters should have to travel off to West Texas to work in the oil fields or the Gulf Coast to work on the rigs. Then they should have clean green jobs here at home.
Welcome to The Light. Police across the globe are using new methods to prevent crime and improve their performance. Now, Pakistani police have come up with an idea to put officers on rollerblades to catch criminals in the commercial hub Karachi. The new armed rollerblading unit is going through rigorous training for over a month with the aim of curbing theft and harassment on the streets. During the training, they were seen carefully balancing on skates while leaping over staircases or lifting their guns. The unit, made up of 10 men and 10 women, would be sent to public places. The chief of the unit says rollerblades make chasing thieves on motorcycles through the city of 20 million much easier.
We felt we needed to come up with some innovative approach to control street crime in Karachi. We analyzed and saw that there are certain spots where crime incidents, say for example mobile snatching, are more frequent. We also saw that criminals use motorcycles that help them run away easily. At times, it is difficult for police teams to chase them from our vehicles.
The unit chief also says that officers would only carry handguns, while in some locations, such as shopping malls, they will not be armed at all. Officers say they can now reach narrow alleys very quickly, where it's usually difficult to go. The rollerblading police are expected to be deployed officially next month.
Niagara Falls on the US-Canada borders is known for its spectacular timeless beauty, attracting tourists, especially during the summer. But this year's frigid temperature has created another spectacular scene at this natural wonder. Visitors to the New York side of the falls were treated with a remarkable view, as stream falling down the Niagara River is now crusted with ice. A rainbow adds more beauty, leading to the most amazing view of the falls. Every day, dozens of people help each other walk across icy stream to take a closer look at the beauty created by the extreme cold weather. More snowfall, low temperature have been predicted for the coming days, meaning people will have more time to enjoy the place.
Iran has inaugurated the Tehran International Tourism and Handicrafts Exhibition according to health protocols. The event is aimed at injecting fresh energy into the tourism industry, which has been badly affected by COVID-19 over the past year. Saman Kujori reports.
Tehran International Tourism and Handicrafts Exhibition has been inaugurated according to health protocols announced by the National Headquarters for Coronavirus Control and following the necessary coordination with the relevant agencies in this field. According to organizers, visiting the exhibition in person will be controlled. Only a specific number of people are allowed to visit each day. Officials and experts believe Iran will achieve a tourism boom after the coronavirus outbreak, believing its impact would be temporary and short-lived for a country that ranked the third fastest-growing tourism destination in 2019.
Although we were under sanctions and at the same time corona pandemic badly affected tourism industry across the country, we have developed and completed many projects in the country during this period. We are very optimistic about the future of tourism industry in Iran because we believe good days are around the corner. Iran is a historically and culturally rich country with abundant attractions.
According to the latest data, 8 million tourists visited the Islamic Republic during the first 10 months of the past Iranian calendar year. Iran ranks first globally in terms of the number of handicraft cities and villages registered by the World Crafts Council. The number of Iranian craft cities and villages stands at 14, while the second place goes to China, which has only 7 craft cities and villages globally registered.
Handicraft exports from Iran before the coronavirus outbreak reached $146 million in the Persian calendar year, which started in March 2019. Iraq and Persian Gulf littoral countries are among the main target markets for Iranian handicrafts.
Under the 2025 Tourism Vision Plan, the country aims to increase the number of tourist arrivals from 4.8 million in 2014 to 20 million in 2025.
Iran's tourism ministry has proposed travel packages under strict health protocols, with the hope of encouraging people to travel and injecting fresh energy to the tourism industry, especially during the upcoming Nowruz holidays. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Feeling frustrated and stressed out, Brazilians have found a place to vent their anger and fury in the newly opened Rage Room. Inside a warehouse on the outskirts of Sao Paulo, people can freely swing giant hammers at old televisions, computers and printers. Demolishing the machines and shattering glass into tiny pieces helps to release their pent-up feelings. The 42-year-old who opened the business a month ago says he has received a fair number of customers wanting to vent, especially during the pandemic.
I think it was the best moment to be able to set this up here, related to everything that people are going through, a lot of anxiety, stress. Sometimes people miss work or even work a lot at home. I believe this here is like an escape at the moment.
Wearing protective suits and helmets, participants write issues that bother them on the walls, turning the words into targets of their anger. One might think how much it costs to break all these things up. The Rage Room experience, however, costs just less than $5.
Tens of thousands of flamingos have turned the Indian city of Navi Mumbai pink. Bird lovers gathered near a lake to watch the migrating flamingos. Every year, flamingos migrate to Navi Mumbai between October and March. They go there from northern and western parts of India and sometimes as far away as Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Iran. Then they fly out in June. This year and last year, their numbers were much higher. Experts say that is because the lake is cleaner thanks to COVID lockdowns. Well, the world's largest snow maze is once again welcoming visitors in Western Canada, offering them a joyful adventure amid the coronavirus pandemic. The attraction opened in mid-February after being in limbo earlier in the winter due to public health measures and unseasonably warm weather. In addition to the giant maze, there are also snow slides as well as snow buildings and huts with artworks inside, so the visitors can enjoy other activities besides getting lost. The massive labyrinth is about 240,000 square feet, twice the size of its record-breaking build in 2019. Designers say the larger layout is a nod to social distancing guidelines.
In 2019, we applied for the title of the world's largest snow maze, which we got in February. And this year, just with COVID and everything, we wanted to make it bigger. And so this year it's about 91% bigger than the world's largest title that we hold now.
The visitors can only have 5 people in their group and masks and face coverings are mandatory. Indoor warming areas are closed and picnic tables are also unavailable due to the pandemic.
Now, after an unprecedented winter storm in some parts of the United States, people in Texas have a rush to rescue sea turtles. The creatures are not used to chilly weather, so they became cold stunned. This is a condition in which sea turtles remain awake but lose the ability to move. Volunteers have so far saved over 4,700 of them off the southern coast of Texas. The rescued turtles were transferred to a convention center and will be freed after the water becomes warmer.
There is a famous quote that love and kindness are never wasted. An Australian couple has proved that this maxim doesn't apply to humans alone. Quincy Jarrett and her partner Matthew have been rescuing animals for the past 10 years and have saved dozens of kangaroos. The couple is volunteers with the New South Wales Wildlife Information Rescue and Education Service. Many of the rescued animals were taken from pouches of their dead mothers after they were hit by cars.
Chrissy says caring for distressed kangaroos gives her a kind of sensation she cannot get from anything else.
It was such an eye-opener to learn how very human they were, how emotional, how, you know, interactive. They're not pets, they are wild animals, but they are so amazing to learn about, and that's something that I think wildlife care gives me that I can't get anywhere else.
Once the rescued animals are in a good enough condition, they are set free during a process that is called soft release. That is when the gate is left open so the kangaroos can come and go at will until they feel safe enough to leave for good. Some animals continue to visit their saviors even years after they were released.
If you walk through London these days, you'll spot tiny handmade shops in some places. Let's see what they are for. The shops have been created by an artist to encourage people to donate non-perishable food to charities. Sean Rodrigo makes wooden miniature food banks and puts them in different areas. He uses 3D printer to create his artwork. Rodrigo believes decorated boxes shaped like shops grab people's attention. Each box holds about 35 cans.
How would the Milky Way look like if it fell from the sky? Maybe similar to a magnificent scenery created by the freezing temperature in northeastern China. Frozen waterfalls in China's Jingpo Lake present a stunning view that attracts visitors even during the coldest days of the year. The chilly weather freezes the waterfalls from side to side with thick layers that are up to 15 meters high. The icy layers cover the cliffs, and they are sometimes as wide as 300 meters. But surprisingly, and unlike the waterfalls, the lake itself never freezes and is ice-free all around the year because of its underground hot springs.
Italy witnessed an amazing natural scenery. This one, however, is all about heat and smoke. Footage taken from Italy's Mount Etna shows thick plumes of rose-colored smoke rising into the sky while red lava turning the mountain slope into a glowing river. Europe's tallest active volcano burst into a new eruption earlier this week in the Sicilian town of Catania. Despite a rain of stones and ashes, authorities said the eruption has not been worrying. Mount Etna has erupted frequently in the past 500,000 years. Its last major eruption was back in 1992.
That's a wrap up. Thank you so much for being with us, and bye-bye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Another controversy for the private U.S. security firm Blackwater. A confidential UN report says Eric Prince, the company's founder and former head, has violated an arms embargo on Libya by sending mercenaries and weapons to support Libyan renegade general Khalifa Haftar. The report, obtained by the New York Times, details how Mr. Prince, a close ally of former U.S. President Donald Trump, deployed heavily armed foreign troops to eastern Libya to assist Khalifa Haftar in the heat of an attack to capture Tripoli in 2019. According to the UN, the $80 million operation included plans for the mercenaries to assassinate selected Libyan commanders. The report raises questions about possible ties between the operation and the Trump administration. Prince did not cooperate with the UN investigation and has rejected having anything to do with the military operations in Libya. However, the report exposes him to possible UN sanctions.
Well, it's all the same thing, that it broke the law and that he was told to do it. I mean, it doesn't really make much of a difference. In fact, the laws or international law and laws are meaningless to the United States. And in 2011, when the U.S. led the NATO bombing to destroy the Libyan government and the government there, and for regime change, that was against international law, but it didn't mean so. They break international law all the time. When they level sanctions against countries, these are violations of international law. And so, you know, that's it's par for the course. It's very telling, though, that they are that they would be doing this use, having this use of mercenaries.
Since 2014, two rival seats of power have emerged in Libya, namely the internationally recognized government of Prime Minister Fayez al-Sarraj and another group based in the eastern city of Tobruk, supported militarily by Haftar's troops. The damning 120-page UN report on Blackwater's contract in Libya was another instance of military intervention by Washington-linked private security companies in the internal affairs of countries around the world. In recent years, there has been a surge in the activity of guns for hire in countries like Yemen, Nigeria, Ukraine, Syria, Iraq, and Afghanistan. Some of the mercenaries have capabilities and equipment on par with elite US troops. But Blackwater is not the only such American firm that is active in conducting high-level overseas operations. Back in May, Venezuela arrested 13 individuals charged with planning an operation in the capital Caracas, two of whom were American nationals. The U.S. mercenaries admitted that they were arrested during a failed attempt to raid Venezuela's presidential palace and seize President Nicolas Maduro.
We had a casual conversation, I guess you'd call it a verbal contract, giving me some vague mission guidelines on training Venezuelans coming here and putting Maduro on a plane.
The two said they had been working with Jordan Goodrow, an American military veteran who leads a Florida-based security company called Silvercorp USA.
The measures that the United States will take for regime change to advance their interests, very obscene, immoral measures, are revealed all the time. What the reason why they like to use mercenaries in a lot of these things and what they do, and then the academy or this group that used to be Blackwater, got its notoriety for doing things that gave the United States plausible denial.
The involvement of the U.S.-backed troops in these countries wasn't the first, and certainly won't be the last. But does the growing number of operations indicate that the U.S. is opting for a more indirect means of intervening in other nations' affairs?
Recently published satellite images by the International Panel on Fissile Material have revealed that Israel is expanding its Dimona nuclear facility in the Negev Desert. Israel has acknowledged the existence of the Dimona nuclear reactor, however it neither confirms nor denies the purpose of the facility. The site has provided the Israeli regime with the material needed for its nuclear arsenal, according to a report by a non-profit organization named Federation of American Scientists. In 2020, Israel possesses close to 100 atomic nuclear warheads that are made from plutonium produced in a Dimona heavy water reactor. However, other sources have put that figure at 300, with some estimates even going as far as 400 nuclear warheads. The Israeli regime has a deliberate ambiguity policy on its nuclear arsenal, which means despite being the only possessor of nuclear weapons in West Asia, it always refuses to accept or deny having any. Israel has always turned a deaf ear to international calls on nuclear transparency, and it has never allowed any inspections of its nuclear facilities. With the US's invariable support, the regime has so far defied the international calls to join the Non-Proliferation Treaty, or NPT. The treaty aims to halt the spread of nuclear arms and weapons technology. This is all while Israel has constantly accused the Islamic Republic of Iran of weaponization of its peaceful nuclear program and assassinated several nuclear scientists in recent years. However, Iran has rejected all these accusations, as it was among the first nations to sign the NPT. In January, Iran's permanent representative to Vienna-based international organizations, Kazem Gharib Abadi, denounced favoritism towards Israel by the International Atomic Agency. He said such a treatment has given the Israeli regime the audacity to ridicule the watchdog and press ahead with its advancing nuclear weapons program in defiance of international calls. Israel's possession of nuclear warhead poses a significant threat to regional stability. The regime has carried out bombing campaigns against Syria for the past years. It's threatened Iran militarily on numerous occasions.
And when it comes to Hezbollah, Israel has repeatedly threatened to destroy the resistance group.
First of all, they want to keep it as secret as possible, but there's another reason for this, and it's because Israel gets a large amount of economic and military aid from the United States. It's the biggest recipient of U.S. aid, and there is a bill that was passed, I guess 60 years ago, the Symington Amendment, which said that we cannot provide aid to any nation that has a nuclear weapon and is not part of the Non-Proliferation Treaty.
Israel's name has been synonymous with aggression, illegal occupation, and war with regional countries, as well as other international crimes. In August 2018, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu threatened Iran with atomic annihilation, right from the regime's Dimona atomic weapons facility. Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif slammed Netanyahu by calling his statement beyond shameless. The regime is the center of fabrications against Iran's peaceful nuclear energy program, which is subject to round-the-clock monitoring by the UN. Israel has made baseless allegations against Iran, saying it is developing nuclear weapons, yet the regime owns atomic warheads and refrains from allowing inspections of its facilities. Unlike Iran, Israel has so far refused to join the Non-Proliferation Treaty, whose aim is to prevent the spread of nuclear arms and weapons technology, in defiance of international pressure. Several countries have helped out Israel to develop its nuclear arsenal. They have secretly sold the Israeli regime material and expertise to build warheads. These nations include the US, France, Germany, Britain, and even Norway.
Well, you can draw the conclusion that perhaps the United States likes volatile regions. The more death and destruction, the better. It survives on this, and it invests extremely heavily in the most powerful military regime on the planet.
However, Israel's nuclear weapons project would never have succeeded without a major contribution from France. Surprisingly, Paris took the toughest line on counter-proliferation when it came to Iran's peaceful nuclear program, whilst at the same time it helped lay the foundations of the Israeli regime's atomic weapons. Whilst Israel has fabricated accusations against Iran's peaceful nuclear program, it's the only possessor of atomic warheads in the West Asia region. There have been growing calls for a region free of nuclear weapons. So why then have the US and Europe themselves turned a deaf ear to such demands?
U.S. President Joe Biden's administration has announced three symbolic gestures toward Iran in an apparent break with former President Donald Trump's so-called maximum pressure campaign against Tehran. Ned Price, a spokesman for the State Department, said Thursday the Biden administration was willing to meet with Iranian officials and other world powers involved in negotiating the nuclear deal. Price said Washington would accept an invitation from the European Union's top diplomat to attend a meeting aimed to discuss a diplomatic way forward on Iran's nuclear program.
Well, the U.S. is trying to play a little game here by saying, I'm going to go to Europe and I'm going to meet Iranians and I want to talk about the JCPOA, and maybe the U.S. will lift some sanctions. It's just the message the U.S. is just not getting it right. The U.S. needs to understand when Iran stopped giving false hope that there is no return to the JCPOA unless the Americans lift all sanctions, apply the lifting of the sanctions, allow Iran to sell its oil and to make deal with other companies as stated in the JCPOA, and then Iran will stop withdrawing from the nuclear deal.
Washington says it has lifted travel restrictions on Iranian diplomats accredited to the United Nations, headquartered in New York, limitations that were imposed by Trump in 2019. Also, in a letter to the UN Security Council on behalf of Biden, acting U.S. Ambassador Richard Mills said the United States has withdrawn three letters from the Trump administration that claimed the U.S. had reimposed UN sanctions on the Islamic Republic. Mills said that sanctions measures terminated in Resolution 2231 endorsing the nuclear deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA, with six world powers, remain terminated. This is why the overwhelming majority of the members in the 15-nation council had described Trump's bid to restore UN embargoes on Iran as illegal, arguing the US was no longer a member of the JCPOA. In a tweet, Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif responded to the US acknowledgement that the snapback mechanism of the JCPOA has not been triggered. He reiterated Iran's position that Washington must lift all sanctions imposed, reimposed, or relabeled under the Trump administration before Tehran reverses its scale back of the commitments under the nuclear accord. Zarif had earlier urged France, Britain, and Germany, three European signatories to the nuclear agreement, to abandon their calls on Iran to act first to salvage the JCPOA and instead demand an end to the US, quote, economic terrorism on Tehran. In a reaction to the US announcement that it would accept the EU's invitation to a meeting of Iran and the P5+1, Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh said P5+1 no longer exists due to Washington's withdrawal from the deal. He repeated Iranian officials' stance that the US must first put its words into action before Tehran follows suit. Even after the US exit from the JCPOA and the reimposition of sanctions, Iran remained fully committed to the accord for a year before gradually reducing its commitments in five steps, citing the failure of the European signatories to the deal to keep their end of the bargain.
Iran made it very clear the government is forced to abide by the decision of the parliament, and the parliament decided to implement several steps one after the other. The first one is the 21st of February. And on the 21st of February, Iran will withdraw from the voluntary protocol and will reduce the sudden inspection of the atomic energy inspector. Therefore, the Americans need to understand that there are other steps that will follow if the sanctions are not lifted.
The country has times and again noted that all the retaliatory steps are reversible once all signatories honor their obligations.
Myanmar has been the scene of mass demonstrations against junta leaders ever since the February 1 coup. Anti-coup protesters have defied a crackdown by the military, taking to the streets in several cities across the country almost daily. Demonstrators are demanding the release of the country's de facto leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, who was detained along with a number of parliament members. They're also demanding the restoration of civilian rule. Myanmar's junta has ratcheted up security measures to quell anti-coup demonstrations, and the internet in Yangon has been down for several days. Junta leaders denied they staged a coup and justified their power seizure by alleging widespread voter fraud in November elections that Suu Kyi's party won. They also pledged to hold new elections soon. This, however, has failed to calm down the situation.
I guess a lot of times with the Burma army and the Burmese dictators, they are always above the law. So why he doesn't calm the situation is because he doesn't want to calm the situation, because he wants things to be under his control, and he wanted to hold on to the power the way he wants to run the country. And that is why, although you will see a lot of chaotic going on, and you would think that if he's talking about the election issues and election is fraud, if that is the case, then why violence?
The army generals have filed multiple charges against the deposed leader, including ignoring an import and export law over walkie-talkies that were found in her home during the search. The Nobel laureate's lawyer says she has also been hit with a second charge, which is violating the country's disaster management law. Observers believe the accusations against Suu Kyi are an indication that the military is seeking a permanent grip on power.
Nobody knows how long the military is going to hold on to the power, but it is very worrisome that they probably may not want to let go the power, because for so many reasons, especially those who are in power, like high-ranking position like Myung Le, He has so much political ambition in order to become the president, and even more so in order to control and have control over his own economic ambitions.
The military seizure of power has drawn global reactions. The United Nations has warned the army of several consequences of any harsh response to protesters. The UN Special Rapporteur said Myanmar's generals will be held accountable for any suppression of the civil disobedience campaign there. The coup also drew reactions from other international players. China said the situation in Myanmar is not what Beijing wants to see. It also rejected social media rumors that China was involved in the coup as complete nonsense. However, China, along with Russia, says the coup is Myanmar's internal affairs. The United States, however, has taken a different stance. Last Wednesday, U.S. President Joe Biden announced new sanctions on those responsible for the coup and any entities linked to junta leaders. Biden said Washington will be ready to impose additional measures. There is also the risk of a new confrontation between U.S. and China, maybe over Myanmar.
I mean, look, yes, the U.S. is talking about threatening to impose sanctions, targeted sanctions especially. And what did they do in the past week? They did impose some targeted sanctions, but it's just on, what, on the gems companies? But the most important thing to follow, to go behind, is the oil and gas company that is owned by the military. That is where they make a whole bunch of money in order to buy their submarines, their warplanes, all kinds of sophisticated weapons, which we call Mag and Mel, the oil company. They didn't do anything about it. That is something we wanted to see the U.S. will sanction.
The two nuclear-armed countries are already facing off on a range of other issues, including the U.S. interference in China's periphery, such as the South China Sea and the Korean Peninsula, as well as the trade and cyber wars between them. Myanmar is just another geopolitical war threat for China and the U.S., but observers believe Beijing has an edge over Washington in this struggle.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. Today, we're going to be delving into the Islamic laws about the ladies, according to Ayatollah Sistani. Before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
The Grand Ayatollah Sistani comes from the family of scholars and pious men. He learned theological and rational sciences from many eminent and well-known religious scholars. At the age of 5, His Eminence started learning the Holy Quran. He was then admitted in a religious center for reading, writing, and for learning basic mathematics and geography. In the beginning of 1360 Hijri, he started studying basic Hausa lessons. He also studied a number of books on philosophy like Sharh Manzuma-e-Sabzawari and Sharh Ishraq. Meanwhile, he attended Kharij lectures by the late Mirza Mehdi Ashtiani and the late Mirza Hashim Qazwini. In the late 1368 Hijri, he migrated to Qum to accomplish his studies in Fiqh and Usul. His Eminence left Qum for Najaf al-Ashraf. On having arrived in Najaf, he began attending Qayatullah Khoi and Sheikh Hussain Hilli's lectures in jurisprudence and the fundamentals of jurisprudence. In 1380 Hijri, Ayatollah Sistani traveled back to his hometown, the holy city of Mashhad, expecting to stay and settle down there. In the same year, he was awarded a permit by Imam Al-Khoi and another by Sheikh Hilli, certifying that he had attained the level of ijtihad, that is, deduction of legal judgment in matters of religion.
Sheikh Jawid, since we are talking about ladies-related laws, according to Ayatollah Sistani, and in the last episode that we started off a series of discussions on that, I asked you a question. Let me ask that question again, but in another form, or rephrase it one way or another. And that is, you know, I asked you whether or if there is a certain age group,
yes,
for the women who experience the state of hate or menstrual blood. And can I ask you another question quite related to that, and that is, does it depend on many factors, such as geography, the geography or the country where these women or girls are
belong
from?
To, yeah.
Because it may be different from place to place, that some girls or women, in fact, are quite, you know, like grown up when you look at them, all right, and when they are still at a very young age.
Yeah.
But when you go to another country, you see they're very small, even if you consider them to be, like, for example, 9 years of age or 10 years of age, but they're still, it's like they're kids.
They are kids,
basically.
They look to be kids.
Yes.
I would like to say that a girl attains the age of puberty, or a girl turns baligh or becomes adult in the eye of Sharia when she completes 9 years of age. So at the completion of 9 lunar years, of course, she is considered to be adult, and she is considered to have attained puberty. At this time and at this age, she might discharge the menstrual blood, and though it may happen that she might not discharge that blood for a few years until she becomes let's say 12 or 13 years old.
Mm-hmm.
So some girls, it has nothing to do. I just, this is my response to your question. I would say that it has nothing to do with geography according to Islamic Sharia. It has nothing to do with the country you belong to. Of course, it has something to do, at least with your lineage.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, depending on what on
genetics.
Whether you, yeah, on what, yeah, on your, let's say,
genes,
and on maybe what tribe you belong to. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
For example, it is said by some religious scholars, though this is not the opinion of Grand Ayatollah Sistani, that the women who belong to Hashemites,
mm-hmm,
or the Hashemite women, they continue to experience the blood and see and discharge the blood until the age of 60.
Mm-hmm.
And those who are not Hashemite, they see the menstrual blood until the age of 50. But this is not...
You mean after that, they're entering the state of menopause.
Menopause, yes. Yeah. That is it. But this is not Ayatollah Sistani's standpoint. He's of the view that all women can see, whether Hashemite or non-Hashemite, can see the blood and can discharge menstrual blood until 60. Yes. And after 60, whatever blood she sees, even if the blood has the sign of menses,
yes,
it's not considered to be menstrual blood. It's not considered to be haiz, and therefore she is considered to be in the state of menopause.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever blood is seen, though the blood is impure, but she has to offer her prayers and do her regular duty, and she can enter a mosque and do everything else.
Yeah. You're talking about the end of the menstruation, but what about the beginning?
The beginning, I said that a woman or a girl can discharge blood at any age, at any time after nine.
Yes.
Because that is the time when she attains puberty.
Right.
She might see or discharge the blood at the age of 9 or at the completion of 9 years of age. She might discharge it at the age of 10 or 11 or 13. Or maybe even later.
Are we talking about lunar years or solar years or Christian years, whatever?
No, lunar years.
Yes.
Yeah. Otherwise, a girl attains the age of puberty at the age of 8 years and 8 months and 20 days.
I see.
Yes, according to the solar calendar.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Yes.
The Office of Ayatollah Sistani is currently providing the following services. 1. Board of Istifta, replying to religious questions. 2. Helping the poor, needy, homeless, and those who have suffered losses by earthquakes and floods. 3. Sending books for people who want to understand and learn Islam. 4. Hajj delegation. 5. Sending preachers. Board of Istifta is a link between Ayatollah Sistani and people. It provides them with answers to questions pertaining to religious, ideological, social, and educational matters in accordance with the verdicts and rulings of Ayatollah Sistani. For more information, visit the website of Ayatollah Sistani at www.sistani.org. You can also ask your questions through the following email, english@sistani.org.
How many days, in fact, does the bleeding last?
That's also a very important question, because there are women who discharge blood for more than 10 days. There are women who discharge, and there are women, of course, who are living in Sunni communities, and they are under the impression that women can discharge blood for 18 days.
Yes.
Because this is what's written in the and non-Shia literature, religious books, okay, fiqh literature.
Yes.
And the Sunni communities of different sects believe that the monthly discharge can go on for more than 10 days.
Yes.
But the Shia religious authorities are of the view that the blood of menses is not less than 3 days.
Yes.
And it's not more than 10 days.
All right.
Not less than 3 days and not more than 10 days.
Mm-hmm.
So if a woman discharges blood for 3 continuous days, there should not be any kind of interruption, okay? For 3 uninterrupted days.
What do you mean by interruption? Like it could be like there could be like for example a gap of 3 hours, 2 hours.
That is
is that what you call interruption? Or 1 day or two, what?
That's what we mean. That's what it could be. The blood could come for, let's say, for 10 hours, and then it might be it might stop.
Yes.
For 2 or 3 hours, and then again it might start discharging.
Yes.
So that's called interruption.
Uh-huh.
The blood should be present, and of course a woman can check herself by inserting something into her vagina,
mm-hmm.
and see whether she is still bleeding or not. If the blood is there, if the cotton, let's say, is stained with blood, then she is treated as a woman in the state of haiz. a woman in the state of menstruation, and she has to, of course, follow the rules which apply to her and which hold good for her.
What if that happens, that interruption happens during the time of her period?
That's also a good question, because a woman sees blood for 3 days or 5 days, okay, and then she stops bleeding. She is clean for, let's say, clean from menstrual blood for 2 days.
Yes.
And then again she starts having
bleeding
for three more days. All these days in which she saw the blood, including the 5 days and then plus the 3 days, okay? And with 2 days in between, okay, she is still considered to be in the state of high. But there's one very important point, okay?
Yes.
And the days in which she does not see any blood, what is she supposed to do? Is she supposed to offer her prayers, do her wajibat, stay away from mosques and touching the script of the Holy Quran, touching the names of the Allah, the prophets, and so on? According to Ayatollah Sistani, the religious authorities have different opinions in this. I have seen, and I don't want to mention the names, I have seen some religious authorities and some marajis' opinions saying that and those days in which a woman is pure from blood, she's still considered to be haiz, a menstruating woman.
Yes.
And she therefore cannot offer prayers, she cannot do anything, okay? But Ayatollah Sistani is of the view that when a woman stops and ceases to see any kind of blood or discharge any kind of blood, she must perform a ghusl haiz, okay? And then she must start offering prayers and then do other religious duties which require ritual purity. And then if she happens to see the blood for three more days or for even 1 day, she has to consider herself again as a menstruating woman, as a haiz, and she must follow the rules of haiz. And of course, the blood in the second stage might not have the same force or signs, okay, or features. Let's say it might be yellowish in color, it might be brownish, and she might even see spots. That's called spotting, okay? Mm-hmm. Spotting. If the fluid which she discharges is even yellowish and very light in color, but it's reddish in terms and in some way, that fluid is still considered to be a kind of blood. Mm-hmm. And therefore, she must follow the rules of haiz.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. That was the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Thank you very much for listening to us. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
IRIB English Radio.